You're listening to The Point. If you've spent time in Provincetown, you've likely noticed a bright orange dory moored in the harbor. The boat belonged to a fisherman known to many in town, Eddie Ritter. Producers Marnie Crawford-Samuelson and Shane Hofelt bring us this appreciation of Eddie and his beloved dory.
A couple of years ago, in Provincetown at the tip of Cape Cod, I chased after a fluke fisherman named Eddie Ritter. Even if you didn't know Eddie, you might recognize his dory, a traditional double-ended wooden rowboat that sat for decades on a mooring near the town pier. You might have seen it in countless paintings and photographs by local artists. The dory was an icon that practically defined Provincetown's port. If you were a local and saw that bright spot of orange reflecting into the deep blue waters of Cape Cod Bay, you knew you were home. This is a story, an appreciation, really, of one of Provincetown's most enduring characters.
I think the very first time I ever saw Eddie, probably it was in 1978, the summer, he caught my attention.
That's Eddie's partner, Stephanie Cady.
He was barefoot and he was walking down the street and he was just like on a mission. These long oars over his shoulder with two little white dogs following him. Deet, 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 like that. He looked like the Pied Piper.
When Eddie came home from Vietnam and arrived in Provincetown in the late 60s, the town was a bohemian artist colony and a thriving fishing port. Eddie was from Brooklyn. He knew nothing about fishing, but took a chance to work as a cook and deckhand on one of the big boats in town.
There was a lot of fish in town. It was Action City.
That's Eddie.
Tractor trailers coming down the wharf every day, two, three of them, 20, 30, 40,000 pounds of fish being shipped out.
He got to fish with a lot of highliners back in the late 70s, the 80s, and into the 90s.
That's fishing captain Bo Gribben. He grew up in Provincetown and was best friends with Eddie's son.
Highliner was like a slang in the fishing industry for the highest producers. He had a really good reputation on a boat.
Being on the big boats, Eddie said, was like hanging with the guys on the street corner back in Brooklyn. He fit right in. But Eddie had a different idea of how he would like to go fishing. In a dory, no motors, no big nets, doing everything by hand. His vision harkened back to a time when Provincetown fishermen sailed on schooners far into the Atlantic, rowing their dories away from the mother ship into the unknown, hoping to safely return at nightfall.
So I keep on saying, oh, I want a dory, I want a dory. This one fisherman from New Bedford, he says, Eddie, I'm tired of hearing you looking for a dory. He says, I have one in my garage. You bring $400 and you can have the boat. So anyway, I went there and picked up the dory, put it on top of the station wagon and brought it back. It was primo. It looked like it was never in the water almost. It was in perfect condition. So there was must have been 20 guys on the beach. They were looking at my dory and they're saying, blue, that blue, that's an ugly color. I mean, it just doesn't fit a dory, they're saying. And then I looked down the wharf, and at that time there were 20 to 30 fishing vessels down there. And they all had dories for lifeboats, and the majority of them were painted orange. So I turned around to everybody and says, you see that color down there? You see all those dories? Orange it is.
For 20 years, from May to October, Eddie fished for fluke in his dory. He'd row a mile from his mooring to his fishing grounds, tucked into the curve of Cape Cod Bay. Eddie went long lining. That's an old-fashioned way of fishing, where you drop a 500-foot line with maybe 100 hooks attached.
I would start working my way up the line. I go to the first hook. If there was a fish on it, I would take it off and rebait it. I go to the second hook, third hook, and keep on going. And sometimes if a fish hits, you could feel the tug, and then you smile. You know when you go back down the line, you have something. If you caught a couple of 100 pounds of fish, you would tickle pink. If I did that 3 times a week, I'd have a week's pay.
If you were on the water and saw Eddie from a close distance, he looked like a one-man band. He had fish coming in, bait going out, multiple long lines, and sometimes a half dozen fishing poles sticking off the side of the boat. Eddie called his days in the dory a piece of heaven.
He must have loved to do it because the normal person would have switched over to outboards or something a long time ago.
That's fishing captain Chris Merle, who grew up with Eddie and calls him a surrogate father.
It's not easy, and for him to get somewhere when the wind's blowing against you is just consistent rowing, 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 you know, digging in deep and pushing that heavy boat. And he would never get towed by anyone either. Like, even if it was windy and it would take him 10, 12 hours to get across the harbor and someone offered him a tow, he was like, no, the dory doesn't get towed. He was very persistent that way. That was one of his things, that no towing the dory.
How do you explain someone like Eddie? He was very social when he wanted to be. A generous friend who'd leave a bag of clams or tomatoes on a neighbor's door. But he was also a bit of a loner, a guy who chose to do things the hard way. He only traveled by foot or bicycle. He was driven to work his body to exhaustion. At home, Eddie obsessively stuck to his routines. Every morning before his coffee, he made his bed with precise military corners. He only took cold showers, and he refused to put on the heater, even in the middle of winter. Eddie saw heavy combat in the jungle in the Vietnam War, friends say, and what he experienced there haunted him.
It's almost like he had to punish himself a little bit for what he, you know, went through. He couldn't stay still. He always had to keep moving, and he always had to be in control. If he wasn't disciplined, then he would kind of lose it. His demons would come in. He said, I was crazy before Vietnam, but, you know, his brother said he wasn't.
In the early 90s, the fluke that Eddie depended on disappeared from the waters off Provincetown.
It's really hard to have facts about why the fish are in here. Some people say it's the seals, some people say it's the environment.
For some reason, they just stopped coming. You know, that's like pretty much when Provincetown started losing its fleet. There was just so much hustle and bustle and so many families involved in it. The whole way of life that I'd grown up watching my father and Eddie and whatnot fishing, it was gone.
He wasn't catching hardly at all. I do remember seeing him and asking him how he's doing, and he wasn't really making it.
He was the eternal optimist. The first year, I'm sure he's like, oh, maybe we'll get him next year. And then the next year, you're like, oh, hopefully they come next year. And then how many years before that started to take a toll on it?
I mean, Eddie just kind of rolled with the punches. He just said they, you know, they weren't there and it wasn't worth him going.
I think it would have to be heartbreaking. I think he could bury his emotions. I'm sure it left him winded at times.
You never really knew what Eddie was feeling. Not really. Yeah, he was like that. He was like an island.
In the decades that followed, Provincetown became more gentrified, better known as a resort and wealthy second home community than a fishing port. Eddie's life changed too. He could no longer fish long days on the water.
He would just say, well, got to get a job. I've never been afraid of getting a job. I just get up in the morning, I walk around town, and I always get a job. It's no problem. So he would. He would just like walk around and talk to people and wind up with a job after one day.
He still chose hard manual work, like gathering and chopping wood, shucking oysters, or building stone walls. Eddie still kept up all of the annual rituals of the dory. In the early spring, he patched and painted it with an extra coat of bright orange that he said was for all the local artists. When it seemed like the right day, he'd go into the bar. He'd gather up 10 guys to help him carry the 700-pound boat down to the water. With the dory finally floating, like a circus master, Eddie'd declare it a good show and buy everyone a drink, even if he owed for the tab.
It's not like he didn't use the boat. He would still go out and, you know, take his therapy rows.
It was just kind of his religion, really. You know, just going out there, and he just loved his boat. Yeah. It was an extension of himself.
For years, Eddie talked of putting a sail on the dory. He still refused to use a motor, and so a sail, he figured, might let him find fish further out. But the aging dory would be hard to rig and was probably unfit for the open ocean. It would be risky, even for a younger fisherman. In any case, it never happened. But maybe talking about the sail kept Eddie's dream of fishing alive. Then, in the spring of 2017, Eddie passed away. He'd been diagnosed with lung cancer that progressed quickly. He chose to keep it mostly to himself. So it was only in the last few weeks that even close friends learned he was failing. Stephanie was with him in his final moments.
You know what he did? His eyes opened real wide. He went straight up. His arms went straight out really quick. His fists were clenched, and then he just whipped them back. He took the last rope.
It was spitting snow, northwest. It was actually northeast and then northwest for a few days. Raw, cut through you, like when it really bites at your face. The boat's normal resting spot was right in front of the old colony on the mean high watermark. And that's where it was. Tipped over, upside down. Somebody had been there that morning. There were flowers on it and a vase and actually a little cross. A few more people had got word of it and joined up. We carried it up the alley, and it was solemn. It was, there was a big reality check to a lot of people that when that boat went up the alley, it would probably never return to that spot.
For Eddie's memorial, Bo and Chris brought the dory to the Governor Bradford, a bar and restaurant in the center of town. Even in Provincetown's off-season when the streets are empty, the Bradford was crowded with people who knew Eddie, or maybe just his dory, and who came to say farewell. For a time outside, the dory became a sacred altar.
We all decorated it. I had a pair of his boots and his raincoat, and then people were putting flowers on it. I put some sunflowers on it, and just pictures and just things like that.
There's people threw a pack of drum in there, rolling tobacco, because that's what he used to smoke. Someone threw a beer can, a nip, and whatever, different little things, were put in there. But no one was really bawling or crying. I think everyone was happy to talk about their memories of him.
When you go to Provincetown's harbor in the summer, it's a busy place. Fishermen, visitors coming and going on the ferries, whale watchers, sailboats and powerboats. But it feels a little emptier now. No longer on its mooring, Eddie's dory's tucked safely away in Chris's basement. It's out of the elements and still decorated from Eddie's service. Some of Eddie's friends hope the dory can be back in the water for another season or two. But that seems unlikely. It's now heavy and waterlogged, soft, as fishermen say. Others dream of Eddie's dory, or maybe even a replica, as part of a memorial to Provincetown's rich fishing heritage and fleet. Lifted on a pedestal by the pier, its oars at the ready, where it would shine again as a patch of bright orange against a cape-tip sky.
That piece was co-produced by Marnie Crawford Samuelson and Shane Hofelt, music by Blue Note Sessions. Coming up after a break, Neptune's Nor'easter, a book about the unexpected and severe storm that struck the North Atlantic in 1962. The storm sank six ships, including a New Bedford scalloper.